My name is Rick Cooper. I'd like to welcome you to today's program. We've got a very robust program for you today with some really outstanding moderators and panel members. We're going to talk about a variety of topics. First, we're going to talk about the current state of the laboratory market and trends in lab valuations. We'll be talking about multiples, talking about which particular types of labs are hot, and maybe some of those that are not quite as popular. We're then going to spend some time talking about preparation for going to market. I know with what we're doing now, I'm currently working with Advanced Strategic Partners, but when I was previously at the law firm of McDonald Hopkins, we always spent some time prepping people to go to market, but I think the time horizon for going to market has expanded, and we're working with people 6 months, a year, sometimes longer in advance of going to market, just to prepare them for the most successful sale. We're then going to talk about what's going on with hospital laboratories, spending a fair amount of the discussion on the sale of hospital outreach laboratories, which, as I'm sure you're aware, has been a very active market segment, but also talking about different types of arrangements that our hospitals are entering into with third parties, such as laboratory management agreements. And then we're going to get into discussion that's specific to genetic labs, and we're going to be talking about basically business and growth strategies for genetic labs. We want this to be as interactive a program as possible. You should have the WOVA app. That's the mechanism through which you can ask questions, so I would encourage you to ask any questions that you have. Those questions will be known to the people up here. Quite often we're not able to get to all the questions, but I'm sure the good folks up here would be glad to answer questions afterwards. The other thing I would say is, The people on the panels remain free to decide if and to what extent they're going to answer a question. In rare occasions, it would require either raise potentially some legal issues or require disclosure of what they might consider to be confidential or proprietary information. So just bear with them if that's a situation. And again, if you have a question that you may not want to ask in a kind of a public forum here, feel free to grab the panel members and moderators afterwards. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Melissa, who I guess is behind me.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rick. So my name is Crystal Contini. I am with the law firm McDonald Hopkins, and I chair the Mergers and Acquisitions Group at the firm. So this first panel is titled Lab Valuation Trends, What Factors Drive High Values and Multiples in Acquisitions of Independent Labs, Genetic Labs, and Pathology Groups. I am joined by an esteemed group of panelists. So to my left, Dr. Corey Roberts, CEO of Sonic Healthcare USA. Chris Johnley, Managing Director of Haverford Healthcare Advisors, and Anil Asnani, Senior Vice President, Strategy and Corporate Development at LabCorp. So we're just going to jump right into the panel questions, and Chris, I'm going to start with you. How have things changed in the last year? Could you give us an overarching view of the market with respect to the sale of labs and path groups, just as a starting point to our panel today?
Sure, happy to do that, Crystal. You know, we keep track of a lot of different statistics concerning M&A activity in the lab industry, and there's a number of different ways to look at the industry. But in short, there were fewer completed announced transactions in 2023 as compared to 2022. That being said, the transactions that were completed in 23 on general tended to be larger in terms of overall purchase price. What's interesting about the lab industry, which is kind of going against the grain that we observe, you know, over the entire economy in terms of M&A activity, is that overall expenditures for lab acquisitions has remained somewhat constant and stable. That differs from, you know, a broad base of M&A activity across all industries, which has, you know, many sources report is less in 23 versus 22. And a big reason for that is economic headwinds, particularly the uncertainty of interest rates. So the lab industry seems to be somewhat immune from the interest rate uncertainty-driven headwinds in M&A in general. There's maybe a one statistic that we like to look at because the information is readily available and it's somewhat unimpeachable because it's published in SEC filings by LabCorp and Quest, who obviously are the largest players in the industry and the most active acquirers of labs in the U.S. And over the last 5 years, there's been $5 billion cumulative between Quest and LabCorp of purchase price paid in lab-related acquisitions. LabCorp accounted for 70% of those of that $5 billion, and Quest, and I'm rounding here, Quest accounted for 30%. Now, that was over 5 years. Over that that $5 billion spend over the last 5 years, half of it was spent in 22 and 23. So said another way, there was $1.3 billion worth of Quest plus LabCorp completed transactions in 2022. And then in 2023, you know, it rounds to another $1.3 billion of completed deals in 23. So not surprisingly, the coming out of the COVID period, the recovery, 2020 was a slow year, as you might expect, in terms of overall spend by Quest and LabCorp and acquisitions. But it's continued to ramp up and has now stabilized at a pretty hefty pace. That would, I think, if one were to extrapolate, would exceed the $5 billion trailing 5 month period. The number of published deals, another statistic that we measure is announcements of transactions. Since many of the acquisitions that take place are acquisitions that involve private companies or involve companies that are not large enough to require disclosure by public companies, we measure just simply completed, you know, announcements that are available to the public through press releases or are commented in industry publications like the Dark Report, et cetera. And in the last 5 years, there were 111 transactions that we tracked and identified. And in 22, 28 of those deals were completed. But in 23, 18 deals were completed. So I think if one considers, I'm not putting a lot of faith in those types of statistics. If one considers, as Rick Cooper actually mentioned, sometimes it takes a year or more to complete a transaction. So something that might be, you know, completed on January 1st versus December 31st after a year's worth of hard work to get it done doesn't seem quite fair. But we struggle to find the metrics that we can. In general, with regard to pathology, more specifically, the number of deals are not what they used to be. In 21, there were 3 completed transactions, 22, 5, 23, 3 completed transactions. They tend to be smaller. And I have to believe that considering the acquirers, some of the more active acquirers in that segment are private equity-backed, And pathology practices are typically valued as multiples of EBITDA as opposed to multiples of revenue, and are financed with debt. That interest rate uncertainty is potentially a contributing factor for the slower pace of pathology transactions these days. Just quickly, Crystal, regarding valuation, it's our sense that valuations in 22 and 23 are higher and perhaps the highest that we've really ever seen in the clinical lab industry. I think a lot of this is driven by competition among the larger acquirers and the primarily the competition. And I think there's a good supply, or there has been a good supply, particularly of hospital outreach businesses that have come to the market, and some very large ones. I mean, we've had, I think, maybe some historic highs in terms of the size of some of those completed hospital lab transactions, and hospital outreach lab transactions. More, I had counted up the number of hospital outreach lab transactions that exceeded 100 million of those that were announced. And that's been a metric that's been steadily increasing over the past 3 years as well. And valuations in excess of 2.5 times trailing net revenue are not unheard of in these larger transactions. And that's up from a longstanding trend of, you know, more in the 1.9 to 2.1 range, you know, for the 10 years, you know, from 2011 through 2021. So we're definitely seeing a step up in valuations for larger clinical lab acquisitions. Just a high-level overview.
Yeah, no, thank you. So kind of given that background, maybe Anil, I'll ask your opinion on this. What factors are becoming more important when buyers are considering an acquisition? What's kind of driving an important thing to you as a buyer?
Yeah, the one word that I would use, and we can extrapolate a little bit beyond that, is just the word fit. I think when you look at the lab industry, it's often easy to say, you know, here are who the large players are and here's what they do, and they all look alike. But in reality, although we do many of the same types of things, in some ways we're very different, and in some ways our strategies are different, in some ways how we pursue the market, even though, again, we do similar type things, are different. And so the one big thing I would say more and more, especially as you start to look at things like health system transactions, specialty testing transactions, and then even anatomic pathology transactions, and then even beyond that, because we don't often necessarily talk about it here, but just a few minutes ago I was speaking to somebody about this, which is even businesses that are adjacent to lab that many times LabCorp will look at and or acquire, it's really fit. And one of the things we were talking about prior as well in sort of an earlier prep session is what's some of the things that, whether you're an owner of a lab, an owner of a, you know, partner, you're an advisor, whatever the case may be, it's really spending time well in advance of making a decision to sell the business or who you're going to partner with, or even hiring an advisor, or doing it in conjunction with an advisor, is really reaching out to parties to try to understand where they're headed and what you can do, or whether you want to do it or not, to be, you know, a potential partner or acquirer of theirs. So as a good example, and I'll pick anatomic pathology as a really good one, you know, now, and Chris has talked about this, and it's heavily in the marketplace. Historically, you might have done more independent lab transactions if you were acquiring laboratories. And in some cases, you might have done some pathology and things were relatively independent. But health systems, as an example, more and more of them are making decisions of saying they may not choose to be in the health, in the lab business anymore, but they really view lab as one thing that's connected. So in part, you know, whether it's their reference testing or servicing their owned or affiliated physicians, or it's the ones that have in the community that use their hospitals, and then anatomic pathology on top of that, they just run one partner who can do all of that for them and with them, and then be able to offer all the connectivity. So it's really seamless within the health system and seamless within the community. And so it's not sort of a one-for-one anymore. It's really sitting down and saying, okay, if a lab like ours, by way of example, has a health system partnership, it's talking to the health systems and saying, what are you looking for? Who in the community might be a good fit for you? And then going out and having a conversation with whether it's one, two, or three different pathology groups as an example to say, what if all three of us, you know, work together to partner to serve, you know, this client or this community? We've done that in a couple of cases, and actually what I would say is two things. The relationship worked really well. It was, if you would have ever told me starting out, I'd be sitting across from the hospital and the pathology group, and all three of us talking about what we want to do for the community and how we're going to work together to serve the community and how we're going to connect IT and how we're going to work on with people, et cetera. It's very rare, but it's certainly happening much more. And then economically, it also makes much more sense because of how, and we can get into it separately, pricing works. But the hospital, because they were happier with the service, was actually willing in some cases to pay more for the same services that they would have just under us because they were working with partners that they really valued and that we partnered with. So I would say it's really spending time to understand how you're, if you're selling to somebody, what are they really looking for and how you fit there. And then as you go through the process, explaining to them or working with them, in the fact that you really are a good fit for their business. I think that's one thing that they're looking for, and it heavily, heavily really does drive valuations as we look at transactions.
Anyone want to add to that? Because I think that's an important piece of the puzzle is what are buyers considering, and I know the two of you have some different perspectives. Maybe, Dr. Roberts, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I think Anil said it well, that I think it's really important for both sides to look for that fit and that something extra. The idea of just buying EBITDA or a multiple of revenue has some merit, obviously, for size and scale and other things. But what we're looking for is something that fits strategically, and that still could be a small deal, for example, if it brings another in-network payer contract or if it brings a special testing that we don't currently have. Those can still be very small deals, but they need to fill a gap of some sort. So I think that is very important, at least in our strategy. There are so many otherwise deals flying over the wall that if you don't have some focus on what you're looking for, and secondly, as the seller, what you're bringing to the table and can articulate that, I think you're missing a really big opportunity. So those are things that may not seem necessarily intuitive, but a small deal can really fill a gap if it's properly done, at least in our opinion.
Chris, anything to add, given that you work with multiple sellers and everyone has a little bit of a different personality, a little bit of a different mix, to maybe their testing menu or how they approach the market? Sure. What are you seeing?
Right. So as an advisor to lab-related companies that are out in the market and desire to be acquired by these guys, it's often not practical to attempt to build these relationships, considering in many cases these companies are our clients' arch enemies, arch competitors, let's say. I'm sure there's mutual respect, but they compete every day, and they perhaps have done that for decades. So it's there's always a challenge, I think, when the sellers need to involve an intermediary to help sort of bridge that gap, and that's part of the role we try to play is to help, first of all, understand the strategic objectives of the acquirers, try to determine our fit, hypothesize what the fit might be, and then try to present that in a competitive scenario, to multiple potential partners at the same time. And in so doing, we have found that it keeps the process moving, and it typically results in the best bid, you know, from an economic perspective in terms of purchase price. But in an ideal world, I mean, it is helpful if there is a pre-existing, collegial and productive relationship between the buyer and the seller. That always helps.
So I love the focus on fit. It's not just dollars and cents, which obviously everyone would agree is important, but I think seeing that fit, understanding how acquirers and sellers line up. So Dr. Roberts, maybe you being the one that has been on both buy side and sell side, can you give maybe sellers some advice to consider when they're evaluating acquirers and maybe how they can best align their discussion points to, you know, describe their value proposition?
Yeah, I guess just by way of background, I was with a company called ProPath, and we sold to Sonic in 2021, and so that's how I became associated with Sonic. I think there are several things. One, I'm the biggest skeptic in the world when I see the announcement come out and say it was a great cultural fit. And I always kind of chuckle and say, yeah, they paid the most money. But I will tell you that that is really critically important. In our instance, prior to any offers even being made, non-binding LOIs, we had agreed unanimously that if we did do a deal, and that was a big if, we were going to join Sonic because of that fit. So there is some, I think that's really important given the length of time that one's going to spend. But I think one of the things that, a couple of things that I would recommend is I think growing a business for the long term foundationally and looking for what you bring that's a differentiator to the market should still and always be the driver. Even if you have an exit as the ultimate strategy, I still think the best way to get to that exit, if that is your strategy, is by focusing on that core principle of what are your good business practices and what's your differentiator. We did not have an exit as a strategy, had been looked at many, many times over the years and had no interest, but none of that changed our view on how we grew the business or how we approached it. So I think that is going to always be the best way to go. Secondly, when we did decide to pause and listen, we did not do a typical process and get an advisor and clean up and dispense of a bunch of expenses to make everything look better. We were in the middle of our normal business cycle and budget. We paused for about 90 days and said we'll get to a go, no go that quickly, so we didn't disrupt what we thought was a really good business plan, and then put a very short closing on it if it was a go. And that's, in fact, what happened from June to December that the whole deal transpired. But I think in when we did that and listened to the people coming in, I know I personally wrote, you know, two-page strategies that I saw from just my side of the fence with each of the partners to see what I thought was the best fit. And I think that's really important because if you're a competitor and an entrepreneur, you don't want to, at least I don't want to just sell and sit back. I want to go on and have great success together with a partner. So that was really, really important to me, at least at that stage in my career, that I wanted to go forward and want to make it clear that we were not there just to herd the cats for the next couple of years, that we wanted to be bold and exciting and grow. So I found that to be a very useful exercise in looking who would be the best partner and best fit, and that's what we ended up doing, frankly.
So that's actually one of the challenges that we often see being the lawyers on these deals is talking to our sell side clients about what does life look like after the transaction and how good is that fit for those who want to be involved in the business post-closing. And I think knowing that on the front end is important. So maybe to focus on a couple of other value-driving matters. Anil, what other things should sellers focus on to drive higher values?
So I think the first one is really understanding where they are, and in part, again, I'll repeat, where they fit into the current market. And then the second one is where they're really headed and how, when they, if they were to go into a transaction, with a company, whether it's a partnership or a venture or an acquisition, how they can really enhance value. So you know, in some cases we can talk about doing a transaction, and let's just pretend for a moment it's just a, it's a clinical lab, founder based. They've been there for maybe 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. Doesn't really matter, but they have a, you know, a great customer base, and that's really, what they're going to sell. No issue at all. Nothing wrong with that. That transaction can get done in many ways all day long. Because somebody who's buying it is really looking in many ways to buying, a customer list and maybe buying more market share and then enhancing their services in that market. But then if you look at other businesses, whether it's things like, again, anatomic pathology or esoteric testing or even an adjacency, it's really, it's again with, it could be the partnership with a health system. It could be a specific amount of testing. It could be an IT platform that is actually better than what is currently in the marketplace that, you know, is producing better information or, allowing physicians or patients to have better connectivity. So it doesn't have to be lab testing. It could be other things around lab that are different. And then where the tipping point comes in for us is traditionally they're saying, we've proven it out, you know, payers love it, physicians love it, patients love it. We just can't move at the scale that a larger company can. We don't have the capital or we don't have the connectivity. But if you do it, we think that if you buy it or we partner with you, here's what it could look like. So again, it does really go back to having things that you either identify very quickly that here's what's unique about us, that's okay, or here's what's not unique about us, but here's how we really fit into the organization. And I think that could be a really, you know, clear driver. And neither answer is right or wrong. It's just what's the better answer. And again, it's what the seller is really looking to do. So in many cases, we've had sellers who would say, you know, I'm going to sell the business, but I'd like to transition out at X period of time. No issues. We've had lots of businesses where their founding members and parents and, you know, their children that are still working there and they want to continue to work there, or it could be by way of example, physicians, pathologists. And we've done transactions where I've seen people join LabCorp and be there for 20, 30, 40 years. Some that have risen to be executive vice presidents of the organization and take on much larger roles than they could have, or other scientific jobs that they could have, that they weren't necessarily available to them there. So I think it's sort of all of those things and looking at the package that I think is really changing what's happening in the current M&A environment. I'll add on a little bit if that's okay, because sure. I think what we, and sure it'll be explored a lot more, it's what is the environment like today? And the environment actually is extraordinarily active. And the question is, why is it active? The reason it's active, and it may sound really strange, is I think a lot of, not just laboratories, but businesses that own laboratories or have laboratories as a part of what they do or partner with laboratories are saying, what do I want to do when I grow up? What do I want to be? Is having lab a part of my portfolio or not? Is having radiology or is having, you know, linen services, whatever the case may be. They're looking at every single thing given the economic environment of tougher to grow in terms of revenue and increasing expenses. And so because there's a lot of activity, again, you're seeing a lot of things. And then on the flip side, because you're seeing so many things, but you can't necessarily always do all of them, understanding a fit, having a relationship with somebody that you've talked to for a long time, understanding how you know, you can do the transaction faster. You can theoretically have fewer bumps in the road in integration because you understand the business and how it comes together. That actually makes it a lot easier to be able to do a transaction. So I think it's very active in terms of the number of deals. But if you want to be put at the high end of the priority list, doing all those things really helps get you there in terms of both timing and I would even say dollars.
So I'm going to throw a little bit of a curveball because it came in on the WOVA app. So I'll let you guys draw straws on who wants to answer. And Anil, you mentioned IT. How important is the lab data strategy, of a particular lab for M&A? And how should one think about the value of that data? Who wants to take that one?
I'm glad to take it. I don't know if you want to.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So actually, and again, this is the merit of being at the Executive War College, which I didn't have a chance to thank Robert, Michelle, and the team for another invitation. It's, you know, it's sitting, it's here, right? And so when we were at lunch, I was sitting next to a head pathologist of a very large health system in the U.S. And we're talking about what's going to be happening in that marketplace, right? And the value of data, the value of AI, the value of digitization. And so I would say that it is in the uptick stream. There are definitely companies that are there today that are quite advanced, that are heavily focused on where they're trying to take data, but they're certainly having issues in terms of running their business, reimbursement, and value proposition. But everybody is very supportive of it, because they know that that's where we have to head to. Everybody else is looking at the data, and there are more and more companies, including our own by way of example, that are saying, we have a lot of data, then what's our data strategy? How do we use it to either monetize the data for ourselves, or to take that data and be better partners with, again, payers or health systems or patients, so that we can do a better job in using lab data to improve health. So I would say that there are varying streams of it depending on where you are in that chain, but no doubt that in order to be more relevant in the future, you'll either need to take that data and do something with it to be more valuable to your customers, or you'll need to partner with somebody to be able to help you do that, because it is going to be much more where we're headed towards things like personalized medicine and companion diagnostics. That's where healthcare is headed, and we're all going to need to be, you know, much more competitive there to serve our end client.
I would just add, I agree with what Anil said. I think that concept of value-based medicine, so using that data to drive outcomes, to drive decision trees, I think is important. I think we'll see how that all plays out. You've all probably heard, just like I have, about the importance of value-based medicine and the soon to be loss or death of fee for service, and yet here we are still. So I don't know when that all turns, but I'm definitely seeing a lot more activity around that. Data, as far as monetizing it in the form of selling it, to use that term loosely, for research and things, that's going to depend a lot on the company. I know our company is really conservative in those regards. So that is not something that we're looking at very intently, without very tight restrictions on how that data is held. So, but data relative to being able to provide better decision making and algorithms is very much on our radar, and we have some products now and working toward that, and I do think that is the future. We talk about lab utilization and stewardship. Well, I think that's going to be a big part of that, is the use of those data to drive proper tests and outcomes.
Well, I really appreciate being a lawyer on the panel, the conservative approach you're taking, and I'll put a plug in for my colleague Emily Johnson. Those of you who don't know her, the area of law surrounding data is very complex. So really understanding the legal issues involved. Everyone likes to talk about the technology driving piece of it and the efficiencies, but then if you don't do it properly, you end up having lawyers ruin your day. So it's really important to, like, consider that as part of your overall strategy. So I appreciate the conservative nature, but perhaps everyone in the technology space doesn't feel the same way. So Chris, maybe I'll go to you. Given all of the complex pieces of the market right now, is now still a good time to consider a sale, if you're an independent lab or a hospital system?
Well, at lunch, I was sitting with John David Klipp from Lab Economics, and he asked me that same question, and of course I said, yes, now's a good time to sell. I mean, I'm just hardwired that way, right? The challenge is you don't always get the opportunity to choose when it's time to sell. Sometimes, you know, whether they're internal factors or external factors, other parties are, you know, helping you make that decision, or, you know, forcing you to make that decision. That being said, something that Corey said resonates with me. You should always be prepared to sell. There are things that you can do to prepare yourself so that, and it's, you know, just basically like they did at ProPath, they ran their business every day. They tried to always do the right thing. They tried to be mindful of what that means to do the right thing, in the way they manage their information, you know, financial and operating statistics, being compliant, thoughtful about the relationships that they entered into with clients and so on and so forth. But as far as the real answer, Crystal, is, valuations in certain segments are as high as I've ever seen them. So if that's a factor to determine, you know, we're constantly finger in the air, you know, testing, which way the wind is blowing, for larger, particularly hospital-based outreach programs, it's probably never been a better time to consider a sale. And what's interesting is we've had sort of an unprecedented level of both in absolute dollars spent in terms of, you know, by larger labs in terms of purchase price for such businesses in recent time periods. But those health systems that made the decisions to sell did so in large part to raise capital because of the challenges that they faced during the COVID period. So they're basically selling part of what they would 4 or 5 years ago had said was part of their core business, to be in the lab business. They're divesting of that because they need to, you know, make an investment somewhere in their health system. So it happens to be an opportune time to sell your clinical lab business from a valuation perspective, but always being ready doesn't hurt either.
Corey, as a buyer in this market, what are you looking at when you are looking at sellers in terms of, is that a group you want? Is that, you know, from a strategic standpoint, what are you in particular or maybe big picture looking at for purposes of strategy and, you know, whether or not it's a good time to make an acquisition?
Yeah, just a couple of things that just on Chris. First, I think that's really important to be creating every opportunity. I like making decisions from a position of strength and not because of outside pressure. So I would definitely be moving towards so that you have the ability to make a decision on a sale if you want to, even if you have no intention to now. I think that's just good business practice. I think, you know, things like a niche test that fills a test menu gap is appealing to us because the decision to buy or build, particularly, I would emphasize that now just because of the human capital that's at such a challenge right now, whether it's physicians, pathologists in this case. There's a huge gap, as you probably all know. Anybody that's trying to hire a pathologist, it's very, very challenging. So that's part of the buy or build when you're talking about expertise. So if there's expertise, even in a small niche area, that can be bought rather than building, might take years to build that expertise and or recruit. That's a real issue now, whereas it used to not be. We have one particular instance where we've been recruiting for a single expert to drive a business, which would be successful. I've spent more than 2 years doing that, and I never have done that in my entire career. So the buyer build, I think, is a little bit different now because of that aspect. And I think also geographies, even at ProPath, we made an acquisition as a private group. Small two-person dermatopathology group, hardly worth the time you might think, but the geography was between two other geographies, added 8 million covered lives, was one of our core competencies, felt like we could bring women's health in that same area that was untapped in addition to their derm, and it worked really well. So I think those kind of pieces that fill in the puzzle a little bit can be very attractive, even if they're not at size. And Sonic made an acquisition earlier this year of Pathology Watch, which is a digital pathology, dermatopathology-specific practice. And that was very unique in that it's actually a pretty small company, not a huge book of business, but it's a technology platform that was very unique and instantly brought digital pathology on a continuum in the dermatopathology space specifically to us. It was very attractive, even though quite a different model than what we're accustomed to. So we really kind of went out. So there are things like that that can make a lot of sense strategically if they're not, even if they're not in the core business.
So it goes back to fit and yes. being willing to be creative as you're thinking about strategy.
And now, the other thing I would say is that the fit, the cultural fit, the thing that I joked about early is really important both ways, because you're going to be stuck with this person that you just married, and they're going to be stuck with you. And so I think it's important both ways. I always advise people that if you're not in 100%, even if I am, that's only half the equation. So I would really think hard about that, because it's a long career to be dealing with one another, and you want that fit to be good.
Anil, does that resonate with you as well in terms of being creative in your strategic planning and the acquisitions that you're looking at?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, going back to what was said a bit earlier, you know, there's the market's always active. There are lots of deals getting done. There's lots of deals not getting done. And the reason that the deals that are not getting done aren't getting to the finish line aren't because they're not good companies or there's something wrong with them. Many times it's because they really haven't necessarily taken the time to do the work to understand, again, how that marriage is going to work on a post-close basis, and to give the buyer comfort that whether they're going to be there or they're going to leave, that they're going to make sure that the transition is orderly and that the buyer is going to get, you know, the value that they expect out of the transaction. And so I'm not saying that there are transactions that don't occur in the marketplace where you have to, you know, everyone has to be, you know, the perfect fit, except there's lots of things that are done in the marketplace where it's just buy on, bolt on, and, you know, everybody kind of knows that that's what's really happening, and that the seller, by way of example, will leave, you know, the transaction day closes. But in many other instances, and here we're talking about much more specialty type sales, whether, again, it could be within the lab industry, it could be, again, where people, even in the lab industry, are really important. Esoteric companies, if they're not just IP-driven, will have lots of, you know, scientists or know-how. That's very important for knowledge transfer. And anatomic pathology, you know, the pathologists, the relationships that they have in the community are traditionally very important. And then if you're especially even selling something that's an adjacency where the business that's buying it doesn't really know how it works, giving them comfort that you're the type of individual that will help transition the business, you'll stay around, you'll stay committed to making sure that you can transition in an orderly way and make sure they get their value. All those are things we take that very strongly in the company. We do not take that lightly at all. And these are not conversations that just happen at a lower level. These go all the way to the executive committee. They're things that we talk about at the executive level with our CEO, sometimes with our board, as we think about transactions. Every transaction that we do, little or large, you know, is, you know, largely in front of our executive committee or board. They see every single thing that we do, and they will ask questions on both sides. I've been to a board meeting, and one time the only question I got wasn't about a transaction that I had done. I had a board member say, "Why didn't you do this deal?" And we actually had to explain how it wasn't actually the right fit for us, and why we walked away from the deal. That's absolutely what companies are taking into consideration. I would say probably now more than ever, given everything that was said a moment ago. The pipeline is very strong. People are really trying to focus on their priorities and what they're going to do and where they're going to spend their time. And then the cost of capital has increased significantly, and it looks like it's going to be, you know, at a higher level for a longer period of time. So making sure that you do the right transactions, it's not every transaction, mm-hmm. is becoming more and more important, I think, these days.
Any final reactions? Because I think we're getting close to our end of time here. Or did Neil pretty much sum it up, I think?
I'll add one more, and I'll give Chris full credit for this. In our prep session, we talked about, you know, getting to know not just LabCorp, but getting to know everybody, right? Get to know all the partners, the health systems, et cetera, and your whoever you think might be somebody you want to partner or acquire with. And I hope it's okay to share this, Chris. Chris said, you know, it can be intimidating for some of these smaller labs or smaller businesses to come out and meet with you. I hope you take this in a humorous way. First, I don't think we're intimidating at all. I will also tell you that many times meeting with you can be intimidating, because it's not just at your lab, but as a pathology group in your town, you could be the preeminent pathology group or you could be the preeminent lab. So we're walking in to see, you know, Dr. Adcock, who runs, you know, Colorado COAG, and she is the preeminent person in COAG, you know, not just potentially in the U.S., but in the world. We make a bad impression with Dr. Adcock, it's going to reverberate through if we walk into a health system. So I would just say everybody's just a person. We're all people. We're trying to find the right relationship and the right fit. I would encourage you, you know, don't be intimidated. Everybody's just trying to get to know everybody, and sometimes the best environment is pick up the phone or answer the phone when you get the phone call, go to a lunch, you know, go to an hour-long meeting, learn about each other. We're not going to share proprietary information about customer list or pricing. It's just to get to know you. But I do think it could really help in letting the guard down. So for what that's worth, if that was ever a factor for, I don't want to be seen with my competitor or I don't want to meet with my, because it says something, it doesn't say anything except for the fact that, you know, you're just talking to somebody. And many times, and I'll promote ACLA a little bit, all the competitors get together to talk about the industry. There's nothing wrong with getting together with us to say, what are you seeing that's going on in the lab world? How do you see LDTs? How do you see this, what's happening? What do you think the future of AI is? So I would just encourage just going out, meeting people, talking to people. I think it, you know, it would open up a world of just more conversation and really, in the long run, lead to more transactions, and I would say better, more satisfying transactions, which hopefully actually are both add more value in terms of people's satisfaction and, you know, I'm sure for Chris's years, more in terms of dollars and cents too. So.
Just to clarify, I think Chris's story was related to my imposing height as being intimidating. So just, I think that's what he meant.
Well, I mean, that's why we're all here, right? I mean, that's part of the great part of being part of the Executive War College is the ability to do these panels, meet people, have opportunities to build relationships. So for those of you in the audience, I think you're in the right place to do that. So thanks everyone for your time. I'm actually going to turn it over to my colleague Elizabeth Sullivan, who is going to do the next segment as part of the M&A panel.
This concludes the presentation. Please visit the Executive War College website for details on the 2025 event.